I'll go ahead and lead us in a word of prayer before we get going here. Hi, David. Good to see you. Let's go to God in prayer. Thank you so much, God, for all that you do for us. We do pray that you watch over us in all that we do, especially as we serve you. We pray that the Bible classes that we have and all the ways that we teach people, especially unbelievers, we pray that we would be blessed in all those activities. Please keep us safe as we drive home later this evening. Be with our family members. And please, God, be with all the church members here at Monte Vista who are suffering from ongoing health or mental or psychological difficulties. We do pray that you be with all of them and help us in whatever way we can to be a comfort to them. Please bless our study tonight. We pray that it would be an encouragement, that it would be very useful, and that we would take some lessons home with us and apply them. We pray this in Jesus' holy name. Amen. Well, thank you, Judah. Well, we'd be remiss if we didn't at least mention the first two parables in Luke 15 because they build on each other. The first parable, of course, is the parable of the lost sheep. You have 100 sheep. One of them gets lost. And I think most people in the world would look at that and go, that's a reasonable loss, you know? Ask any business person, anybody who is manager of a store. I mean, and they build in loss into their budget. They just assume that there's going to be things that are shoplifted. They assume that products are going to break. They just assume that there will be some loss. And I think most people would say, okay, you know, you have 100 sheep. It's just normal that you're going to lose one here and there. But this shepherd is so diligent that he's not going to give up on the one lost sheep. The focus then on the first parable of the one lost sheep is the idea of that which is lost. I think that's kind of the focus. Is the focus is on the sheep itself that gets lost. In verses 8 through 10, you have a woman who has 10 silver coins and loses one. And the stakes get a little bit higher. You go from 1 out of 100 sheep to 1 out of 10 coins. And it's very likely that the coin that they're talking about is a coin that would have been equal to either a day or up to a week's worth of food. So we're talking about losing one coin means losing several days' worth of food in the process. So the stakes are getting higher. This is actually something that might affect her life and the outcome of her life. And I think the focus on this one is the search. I mean, she puts all kinds of thought into looking for this coin, and finding the coin is really the object of her entire day's activities. And when she finally does find it, she says to all of her friends and neighbors, "Rejoice with me, for I found the coin which I had lost." One lesson we take away from the first two parables is, do you show that kind of excitement about anything in life? I think that we live in a culture where we try to play it cool about things. You know, it's kind of everything we do, we got to play cool. I was watching something on the internet the other day, a BuzzFeed video about stupid things that everybody does, but we don't realize everybody does it. And it's that when you like get lost or make a wrong turn, act like you meant to do it. We all do that. You know, you're walking down the street and you miss a turn. You kind of go like this and you look around like you're looking at the skyscraper above you or something. You know, do you really get excited about anything anymore? Or do you just kind of play it cool? We try not to cry. You know, men aren't supposed to cry. We try not to show too much emotion about things. And yet these two people in these parables, it's one sheep out of 100 and a coin that she lost under her couch. And yet she's telling all her neighbors like, I found my coin! I found my coin! I just don't think that we get as excited about just about anything. I mean, there's very few things that I think we really are willing to kind of show our whole hand and really go all in emotionally investment-wise. Yeah, right?
It's kind of like, I mean, the context here of what he's saying, or of why he's responding with these two parables is super important to understanding each of these.
Yeah.
Because it's these tax collectors and these sinners who he's eating with, and the Pharisees just can't stand it.
Yeah.
They don't understand why Jesus is receiving people who are like the lowest in society. And so these all of these parables after this, I feel like, are kind of like a response to to that situation. Here's why I care about, you know, these undesirable people.
And again, it's things that most people would just be okay with losing. I mean, okay, it's a day's worth of food. That coin is worth. I get it. But you still have 9 others. You're still going to eat for the next 9 days. You can probably get another coin at some point. And, hey, the coin might turn up on its own. You know, we kind of say that instead of searching for something, we just say, well, it'll turn up. We don't go looking for it. We'll just say, ah, it'll turn up. These are things that most people would just give up as lost. And the people in the parables have this abnormal attachment to them. It is an abnormal zeal for finding and restoring these objects. So you're right. The Pharisees looked at a lost world and they said, eh, whatever. You know what? As long as we're okay, it doesn't matter. And let's be fair. You know, Judaism was, in a sense, a proselytizing religion. They were open to receiving proselytes. They were open to receiving Gentiles who would then be circumcised and obey the law. And you know, there were certainly examples that we have in the Bible of people who were proselytized. So, you know, the Jew, and I think Bruce summed it up really well in Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah, he summed it really well that the Pharisees, in a sense, would have been okay with receiving proselytes, but it was a very passive kind of evangelism. It was like, well, if you want to be a Jew, well, just make sure you go through all the steps, follow all the rules, and we're okay with it. But it wasn't going out looking for it. So to them, the tax collectors and the sinners might as well have just been a, you know, a 20 that you lost under your couch. You know, like, okay, whatever. That's no big deal. I'll take a loss on the 20. That's fine. The stakes get higher, though. You go from 1 out of 100 sheep to 1 out of 10 coins, a whole day or a week's worth of food, to your very own son now. So let's go ahead and read this parable now. Let's get a volunteer to read the first half of it. We'll go 11 through 19. Okay, we'll go all the way up to the point where we see the Father again. 11 through 19 of Luke 15. Who wants to do that for me? All right. Thanks, Alan.
There was a man who had 2 sons, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me. And he divided his property between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had, took a journey into a far country, and there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into the fields to feed pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, How many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread, but I perish here with hunger? I will arise, go to my father, and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants.
So you go from losing 1 out of 100 to losing 1 out of 10 to losing 1 out of 2. And it's almost like Jesus is kind of honing in, you know. He's drawing his listeners in. It's very approachable. Okay, 1 out of 100 sheep, that doesn't hit me real close to home. Okay, I can take that parable. 1 out of 10 coins, we're starting to hone in a little bit here. It's becoming a little more serious. Okay, Jesus, I see what you're saying. Now he says, what if 1 out of 2 sons left you? What if 1 out of 2 of your own sons left you and took his wealth with him, your wealth, really, to a faraway country, squandered it, and was in complete and utter misery? Now, this is like that, kind of like that last dagger. I mean, I'm not saying Jesus is aggressive like that, but it's that in the conversation, as he's trying to drive a point home, to those who were listening to him, this is that last, like, man, if you're not getting it yet, this one's going to hit you real close to home. This one's going to really hit you close to home. The man had 2 sons. The younger of them, who would have had potentially access to a third of his father's wealth. Traditionally, the older son got a double portion of his father's wealth, and the younger son would have gotten whatever was left over. Whatever was left over was generally divided between all of the younger sons equally. So the oldest son would get a double portion, and that all the other sons would divide up the rest. And since the man only had two sons, well then, the first son gets a double portion, and the second son would basically just get that third portion, that last portion all to himself. So he essentially takes what we could safely assume to be a third of his father's movable wealth, not land or houses, but anything that can be picked up and moved. He gets a third of his father's movable wealth, basically liquefies it, and takes that money with him to a foreign land. What do you think about the setup to the story? What kind of thoughts do you have running through your mind as far as just this first setup to the story? Remember that families were a lot bigger than they were now. You know, if you had two kids is actually pretty typical now. So I think it would have been pretty atypical for a man to just have two sons. So to me, it just kind of emphasizes the value. You know, it's not 1 out of 10 sons or 1 out of 100 sons. This is 1 out of 2 sons. Half of your progeny just got up and walked out the door, claiming that he wants everything that's his and he doesn't ever want to see you again. I just think that that would just really... I don't have a lot of kids. I just have 2 right now. And I just think, I don't have a whole lot of kids to lose, you know? Like, I mean, if one of them was gone, that's a lot of children that I'd be less. 50% of my kids that would be just up and out the door. And I think it's one thing to lose a kid to a tragedy. And I certainly have not experienced that personally, so I'm not saying I'm any kind of expert on it. But, it's almost like it's one thing to lose a kid to a tragedy and to have some closure. Like, well, he or she is never coming back. That door is closed. That part of my life is over. It's another thing to just never know, like, well, my son left. I never heard from him again. Where is he? What is he doing right now? What is he doing with his life? Is he hurt? Is he in a ditch? Is he dying? Is he thriving? And I think that that lack of closure would be really, really hard for the father to bear.
Especially since his son chose to leave willingly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not like his son joined the military or something. And it's like, well, he's probably in Afghanistan fighting for our freedom or something. It's, no, he basically took a third of my wealth and willingly left. It never says why. I mean, we can speculate. I guess let's take 5 minutes and just for pure speculation's sake, why do you think the son left? Yeah, Joan.
He's tired of following his father's rules.
Hey, you know what? Tired of following his father's rules. I think there's plenty of, precedent in our time to see that that's often the case. Tired of following his rules. And if you could just go up to your father and demand a whole pile of money and walk out, which, by the way, something to understand is that was not typically how things were done. You know, sons did not get their estate or their inheritance until their father was either dead or on his deathbed. So this was not even the typical way that they went about this process, which I think shows something amazing about the father, that the father is willing to let his son willingly go off with his money, when it really wasn't the proper time for it anyway. What does it say about the father, I guess? I mean, give me something. What does it say about the father that he's willing to go along with something that was really not kosher for the time?
I think it highlights free will.
Yes.
You know, God lets us make bad decisions. He lets us trip over our bad choices. And, a lot of people wonder why God allows us to do those things, but that just is highlighted to me.
Yeah,
and that he didn't actually set him down and like interrogate his motives or like figure out.
Yeah.
Okay, well I'll give it to you, but you got to tell me what you're going to do with it.
Yeah.
You know, he there's a certain level of trust there that went into that. He just gave it to him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he knew his son. Presumably, he probably could have guessed. You know, that this he wasn't like going to. Start a farm on the next lot. He wanted to go. Yeah.
He wanted to be out of there. And the parallels to God are just jumping off the page. I mean, that's the point of the parable, is for us to look at the parallel between the Father and God, in the sense that, if we want to go off and live riotously, And if we even want to abuse the blessings that God willingly, freely, and happily gives to us, you know, He blesses, every young person is blessed with He's blessed with youth, for example. Most young people, those who don't have some kind of physical disability, you know, accepted, of course, but most young people have energy, they have vitality, there's strength there. And so, you know, every young person then is gifted by God with abilities that the older you get, you just wish that you have. You know, every 40, 50, 60-year-old person goes, I wish I had the energy I did when I was 16, 17, 18 years old. That's a gift that God just gives. Every young person, you have youth and vitality and strength. And what do most young people do with that? Well, they go and live riotously with it. They are the prodigal son. It's a gift that God happily gives to us. He could have easily, in His creation, designed it the other way around, that you know, the first 20 years of your life are spent being decrepit, and you get stronger as you get older and more mature. But no, you have strength when you're least mature, and maturity when you have the least amount of strength. You know, it's that kind of inverse that we have. God could have designed it another way, but He didn't. So He gifts every young person then with all of his youth and vitality. And there's other kinds of gifts like that as well. But I think, you know, that parallel to God, that God is going to give us a great life, you know, in certain ways. And He's going to do it happily with really not a whole lot of strings attached in terms of immediate consequences. Yeah, Alan?
Just to speculate a little further, and it is just speculation about why He left, but when you start thinking about why people leave the Lord, you know, he thought he could do it better than what his father's doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these people are kind of keeping me back from doing it the right way.
Yeah.
You know, and when you examine why people leave the Lord's church, why people leave the Lord, you know, I think they feel like they're being held back by the commandments, you know, by the Word of God. But that's actually freedom. You know, there's freedom in doing it God's way.
Well, and that's Romans chapter 6. You know, Romans chapter 6, the last 6, 7, 8 verses of that chapter, he talks about how, you know, you were enslaved to sin. Slave was sin was a taskmaster. You were enslaved to it. So be free from sin so that you can be enslaved to God, which really is true freedom. But that's exactly what you're saying. It's all Romans chapter 6. Yeah, Brian?
Well, let's just go back in Romans chapter 1. I mean, that's, you mm-hmm. know, in the beginning when he's talking about the Gentiles, that's kind of exactly the picture that he paints there when he says in verse 28, even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do the things which are not fitting. And then he gives this list. You know, God just let them go and They should have known better. They should have seen God in creation. They should have seen the evidence of God. They should have known better. But he gave them over to that and let them do what they wanted to do.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. I think that's a really good point. God allows us to fall into traps that really we ought to know better. I mean, we really should know better. But God allows us to fall into traps. We can, you know, ask why, but I think the answer to the question of why does God allow us to fall into the traps is answered by the parable of the prodigal son. The prodigal son never would have learned anything if his father had held him down, if his father had tied him to a tree with ropes to prevent him from running off into the world. Sure, he might not have made the mistakes. You can put your kid in a barrel, seal the top of it, give him an air hole and put some food and water in, you know, once, give him a bucket of fish heads once a week to gnaw on, and, you know, your kid might never commit sin that's out in the world, but you haven't changed anything. I mean, the kid might still want to go. So nothing is really essentially and effectively changed about him. So really the answer to it is, it's just built into the story here, that God allows us to fall away, just as the Father allows His Son to do this, because He trusts that there is a higher lesson to be learned. And I think that's what you find in really good fathers. I'm not gloating or anything, because I don't know, well, I know some of your fathers, actually. But I don't know everybody's father in here, but I had a really great father. He was the kind of father that reminded me a lot of this one in Luke 15, where he selectively allowed us to make mistakes. You know, he was always really careful about it. He didn't just let us do whatever we wanted, but Dad was always really good about knowing when the right time to kind of let us go was. Very selective, almost like he was prescient, like he knew that would blow up in your face. And it was like the times that he was most certain that that would blow up in my face, that's when he would say, well, Ryan, go ahead. That's fine. Almost like he just knew the future, that that was going to be something I would regret later. And so Dad was always really good about letting us make certain mistakes on our own, because sometimes you've got kids and they just have to learn that way. They just have to learn by touching the stove. You know, you have to let kids make the mistake, just as God lets us make the mistakes, because there's a greater lesson that can be learned. Now, we have to trust that when God allows that to happen, that God is with that going to give opportunity to repent. And I think there's some trust that we have to have in God as well in that regard. So he goes not many days later. I like that the writer very clearly points out, not many days later. Once that money was in his hands, it did not take him long to be out of there for good. Not many days later, he gathered everything, went on a journey to a distant country, got as far away from his father as he could, probably to avoid his father's judging, prying eyes, probably to avoid being guilt-tripped by his father if he knew what he was doing with his money and his time. We want to go to that distant country. I caution young people, and I know we don't have any almost college kids in here, so we'll keep the lesson short on this, but when high school kids talk to me about college, and I have several sermons that I do that I've done on picking college and picking a career path and everything like that, I really caution people not to get sucked into the dream of going away to college. I think we get it kind of stuck in our heads sometimes, like, you know, I want to go away to college. You know, if I'm from Arizona, I want to go to University of Florida. I want to get away and go to Virginia Tech. I want to, you know, study abroad. I think there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing sinful about going far away and doing that sort of thing. Then, like, judge the motive, you know? Try to weigh the motive. Try to weigh what's going on. We're so excited to go to the distant country, but I really caution young people, like, why do you want to get so far away from your parents? Like, what is in that distant country that is so appealing? Why do you want to go so far away from your parents? Now, some people go to a distant country because that's actually where the opportunity is, so I'm not saying that is a wrong thing at all, but I just think it's worrisome when kids want to go to their distant country like the prodigal son. Anything else up to this point? Any other comments you want to make from the first few verses of this parable?
To carry the metaphor that you and Brian were talking about, you know, the slavery of sin, you know, first it feels like freedom. Mm-hmm. And here he has all this freedom, it seems, to just do whatever he wants. But then it grinds to a halt, just like sin seems to grind people down, you know, and hopefully they realize what's happening to them.
Yeah.
And we see the results of that next.
Yeah, well, I keep hovering around it. I'll just quote Romans 6 and verse 20. For when you were slaves of sin, you were free in regard to righteousness. You thought you were free, at least. I think that's the intimation, is when you were slaves of sin, you believed that you were free in regard to righteousness. Therefore, what benefit were you then deriving from the things of which you are now ashamed? For the outcome of those things is death. It's death. When you have a whole bunch of money in your bank account, and you have sudden, unexplored freedom, uninhibited freedom. Yeah, of course you feel like you're like gliding on air right now. You know, the world's your oyster when you got a bunch of money in your bank account and you have all this uninhibited freedom. Of course you feel pretty good at that time. But, you know, by spending all that money, he was basically digging his own grave. He was, you know, punching nails into his own coffin. When he had spent everything, it took him till rock bottom. I think that's interesting, right?
Well, and we know how the story ends.
Yeah.
But if you imagine, what if the father didn't take him back?
Yeah.
Then he's really creating his own coffin. I mean, what would be his end?
Yeah. He seemed to believe, and that's probably because his father was a good dad, but he seemed to believe that he always had a backup emergency pressure release outlet. You know, he, in the back of his mind, there was always something that said, you know, if this really, really goes bad, I could probably come groveling back to my father. And that's probably because his father was a good father. You know, good dads leave the door open. Even when their sons make a whole bunch of mistakes, dads never stop being dads. They never stop being dads. That's something that somebody told me one time that I am only just now. John, go ahead.
Verse 17 says, but when he came to himself, since prior to this point, when he was away from his father, he wasn't entirely in his right mind.
Yeah.
And so...
he was drunk on sin.
Yes.
Yeah.
It tells us about the way that he was thinking.
Yeah.
But it also means that he wasn't what God had made him to be when he was out there doing this thing.
Yeah.
And becoming a part of this.
Yeah.
And he realizes that about himself. It changes what he does and where he goes, etc.
Yeah. Well, and that's because, again, I keep saying it's because he had a good dad. A good dad will almost beat into you an identity, you know, that you have. It's like on a car, you know, if you look on the window of like the driver's side of a car, the VIN number is usually laser etched into it. You might beat up that car, get it covered in mud. You might do all kinds of things to that car. You might paint it a different color. You might put a spoiler on it. You could do all kinds of things to a car. But somewhere underneath all of that adjustment and change, that VIN number is still laser etched onto the window of that driver's side car. The driver's side of that car. It's still there. And a good dad will try to imprint. You have an identity, and your identity is based on God. It is based on something that is bigger than yourself. And I think that's what happened to this guy, is he got all this money and all this freedom, and he went crazy with it. He was drunk on sin, and it just clicked. He came, New American Standard says, he came to his senses. And it's almost like he took his hand, he swiped away the mud from that window. And underneath all the mud and the grime, he swiped it away and he saw that VIN number was still etched on there. There was like something that his father implanted that says, you are not that person. You are not that person. Yeah, Brian?
Well, I think it's really interesting because it's not that he just ran out of money or ran out of stuff.
Yeah.
Like, that was part of it. But then the famine came.
Yeah.
So not only is he not only has he spent everything, but now he's required to actually have saved up enough to get through this time. So it's kind of, you know, even if we can see a clear path, like we've got a plan in our mind. Maybe he had a plan in his mind about what he was going to do when he had nothing left. You know, there's always that amount of like preparing for the unknown, or the unforeseen things that we need to be, you know, careful of and thinking about.
Yeah.
He probably did have a plan, but it ran.
Yeah. Well, in his, whatever it was, when he finally reached this point, like this was the moment when he was sitting there being envious of pig slop. When he's like, when his mouth is watering because he's seeing the pigs eating the garbage, that, you know, when you reach that point, you go, yep, I'm out of ideas. You're like, I'm fresh out of ideas. I got nothing. You're envious of pig slop. It's just, you gotta go, I got nothing. There's nothing left.
And when he's out of ideas, finally he sees, it's like sometimes the possibilities have to close in to see yourself
and
see reality.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. You know, the doors have to be closed. The doors need to be shut. You need to be at rock bottom where you realize there is no other way. And it's like, thank the Lord that the guy didn't die somehow in all this process, because something we got to realize is not everybody gets this chance. And this is a warning that we need to give to unbelievers or Christians who've fallen away or who are getting into sin. We've got to warn them. It says, you might read Luke 15 and go, well, I could just be the prodigal son. You know, I'll always have time to be the prodigal son later. You might not have time. Not everybody gets this chance. Not everybody gets this chance. And I think just we need to warn people. Don't assume that just because the prodigal son had an opportunity that you're going to have the same opportunity at some point.
Well, going back to the context, right? The father here is you could think of him as God or Christ in the example. And the prodigal son is most likely the
Gentile.
The Gentiles, yeah. or in that specific context, as he's saying, they're probably the tax collectors and, you know, the sinners that he's eating with and associating with. He's probably referring to those people
who are probably Jewish.
Yeah. So in that sense, he's, you know, these are the people now who have, you know, who have a chance. These are the people who still have a shot to come back. It's kind of like the physician, the story he talks about being the physician of those who are sick, not of those who are well.
Yeah. Good point. Well, I like in verse 17, a little side note here about the father. How many of my father's hired men have more than enough bread? I'm going to ask you a question at the end of our, you know, near the end, so you can start thinking about it. The question is going to be, who do you think the main character of the story is? Is it the prodigal son? Is it the older brother? Or is it the father? And there's no right or wrong answer. I just think, you know, from each of our perspectives, I'm curious what you're going to say. There's certainly enough information in this parable for us to say, you know, the main character is the dad. You know, the dad is, he's kind of the ever-present character in this story, that no matter how far the son goes, no matter how bitter the older brother is, the dad is kind of the one he's the thread that runs in this whole story. And I think it's a great little detail that the father takes care of his hired men also. This guy is not a slave driver. This guy is not cruel. He's not unfair. Even his hired men, he takes care of like their family members. They have more than enough bread. I just thought it was a nice little side note here. So what is his realization here in verses 18 and 19? I will get up. To me, that phrase is an indication of how difficult this is. I will get up. It's not just I'll go. It's I have to get up. I will get up. I have to exert some effort now. Something has to go into this process. It just, to me, it shows kind of the labor behind all of this, that this is the hardest decision this guy has ever had to make.
You ever had to say you were wrong?
To Rebecca, plenty of times. Yeah. It gets easier.
It's like the Fonzie syndrome, right? I mean, I was...
Yeah.
Like, you just don't want to say it. It's not something that's comfortable.
Nice Fonzie reference, by the way. Very good. I think 18 is, that's the hardest decision that this guy has to make. Leaving was easy. Being envious of pig slop was necessity. But going back to his father, that's what takes the effort. I will get up and go back to my father. I've sinned against heaven and your sight. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired men. And this is hard to do, whether it's to dads, and there's, you know, my dad and I certainly, you know, there's times where I had to do the dad. I've sinned against heaven and your sight. I made a big mistake. I need some help getting out of this. Every one of us can think of the times where dad was there for us, because dads are dads. They'll always be dads. No matter how old you get, dads are always going to, they'll always be your dad. Same goes for moms, of course. Let's not forget that moms are awesome too, but it's just that it's a father in this particular story. So that's where we are here. Anything else up about the son through verse 19 before we look at the father's response to his homecoming?
Just worth noting that he's not expecting
taken
back as a son.
Yeah, he's not expecting a whole lot. He's assuming that he's going to have a pretty humble existence from here on out. And that's a very mature attitude. I think it takes a lot of guts to go back and say, I'm willing to take the lumps. You know, I'll take whatever you can spare. I don't expect a lot. He could have been arrogant and come back and say, well, I spent all your money, Dad. What are you going to do? Boys will be boys. And he could have had his whole list of excuses all prepared. And I'm always really cautious about preparing excuses for myself when I know I've done something wrong. I don't want to try to weasel my way out of it. It's always best to just confront and say, you know what? I take it. I've sinned. I take responsibility for it. And I'm going to take my lumps. Okay, I'm just going to be honest and just take what's coming to me. So he didn't expect a whole lot from his father. And in verse 20, so he got up. And that took some work. He got up and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him. And I don't want to read too much into that particular phrase, but when I read this story, I see an indication that the father was looking. That the father had never lost hope that maybe his son would come back. No matter how far away his son was or what his son might have been doing, he didn't really know what was going on. But he was always there looking, always ready. I think it's good that God doesn't ever close the door. He doesn't ever shut the door on us and give up. And as long as there's breath passing between our lips, I think there's always hope in God's eyes that the prodigal son will return. So I think that's, again, I don't want to overplay that or anything, but I do think it's worth noting that this son was a long way off and his father saw him. There was an expectation. Some commentators believe also the fact that he had the fattened calf, that maybe that calf was being fattened in preparation. You know, that maybe, I mean, certainly you could expect that any well-to-do person is always going to have a fattened calf on hand for some kind of celebration, but some commentators think that's a little detail that just is an indication that the father always had a fattened calf ready for his son's homecoming. I don't know. That may or may not be the case. Can somebody read? Let's go and just read to the end of the story. Let's go 20 through the end of the chapter here.
And he arose and came to his father, but when he was yet a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. And the son said unto him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in thy sight, and am no more worthy to be called thy son. But the father said to his servants, Bring forth the best robe, and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand, and shoes on his feet, and bring hither the fatted calf, and kill it, and let us eat and be merry. For this son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to be merry. Keep on going on through.
You know, let's go ahead and hold off on the older brother. Let's talk about this homecoming first before we deal with the other brother. Thanks for pausing there to stop us. This father, you know, this guy's got a lot of giddy up to him. He runs to the son and embraces him. He says to his slaves, quickly bring out the best robe. There's a lot of giddy up to this guy. He began to be merry at the end of verse 24. I close my eyes and I picture this man. He's doing a lot of hopping right now. He's kind of hopping and jumping around and just kind of doing this. His heart rate is up real high. This guy's just got a lot of giddy up, which goes back to the previous two parables of, you know, this woman was zealous about finding her lost coin. It was a 20 that was lost between the couch cushions. And she's like calling her neighbors and rejoicing. Are you excited about anything in life? Or is it just kind of football or a promotion at work? I mean, what really gets you excited? Is it the earthly things, or do you really get excited at worship? Do you get excited when somebody gets baptized? Do you get excited when somebody deals with sin in life and resolves to do better? What really gets you pumped up and excited? And I think that all of these parables are sort of a call to us, like, dude, get some excitement here, you know? Have some zeal. It's okay to be jumping up and down when something great happens. So that's one thing that I would note. What else do you see about the father in this homecoming?
Well, and on that point of the, I love that detail about him running to him.
Yeah.
And, you know, you do get this picture in the earlier part of the book of kind of this stately master of the property,
mm-hmm.
but here it gives some, to me, it kind of gives some commentary too on draw near to God and he'll draw near to you. Like, mm-hmm. he's not just easing toward us. If he sees us coming, he's running to us, you know,
yeah,
with a celebration of
Stephen. Ooh, I like it. That's a good point. There's no, you know, there's nothing about coming to God where God says, well, 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 look who it is. So, you have something to say to me? Go ahead, spit it out. There's nothing about God where he's, and it, you know, I use just the auditorium and coming down the aisle as an example because we're right in here and it's a visual thing. But it's almost like the moment that your backside gets off the seat and you start walking down the aisle, you know, you try to picture the Spirit of God being in our presence, rushing to that person, grabbing his hand and saying, dude, don't walk so slow. Get up here, man. There's some zeal there with his Father that's like he runs to him. He's not stationary. He's not stagnant. And he's not folding his hands going, well, 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 look who came crawling back. Jeremiah 31, right? Jeremiah 31. And I will forgive them their sins and remember them no more. He's not going to sit there and guilt trip us. He's not going to grill us. He's not going to say, so, what have you been up to the last few years? Haven't heard from you a whole lot. Prayer life not been going well for you?
I think that's what I get, is the lack of questions.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of people are willing to say that they would forgive, but we want to know, you know, the details. Sometimes we want to prick and pry into people's lives and just, you know, not kind of taking us and God out of the picture and just talking about us and, you know, the brethren, kind of the siblings picture. Mm-hmm. We don't really have to cry about it. I mean, it just, if they're willing to come back, let's be excited about it.
Well, he shows this reaction without a single word from the son.
Yeah.
He has compassion on him when he sees him putting one foot in front of another toward him.
Yeah.
Like, and not, you know, not before or not after, I guess, he grovels and says, you know, oh, I really have, you know, done nothing worthy to be your son anymore. He feels this way well before even that. So.
Yeah, yeah. I like the words he says, this son of mine was dead and has come to life again. He was lost and has been found. And they began to be merry. This is just such a wonderful idea of, you know, the rebirth. We talked about Nicodemus a couple weeks ago in a Sunday morning lesson. And you know, not necessarily baptism, or we could argue about that, I guess. But just the idea of, you know, you need to be born into God. There needs to be a restart. There needs to be, just hit the reset button. It's fresh from here. And, you know, you were dead, but you're alive. And I don't have to ask you a bunch of questions. I don't have to grill you or interrogate you. If you vow to live better, and if you vow to start fresh and never let that past life creep back in, then I don't have to know everything. I don't have to know what you did. As long as I get a promise from you that we're going to move forward instead of move backward, or that we're never going to let that old past creep in again. So I just love this. He was dead, and he's come back to life. He was lost. He has been found. There is, I think, a subtle allusion there to looking forward to New Testament restoration, New Testament baptism. That's probably not entirely Jesus' intention, but you know, Jesus never did anything by accident. And if there's language or imagery there that sort of points to rebirth in the body of Christ, it's probably somewhat intentional on Jesus' part, kind of helping us kind of look forward a little bit to some of these images here. Now, I will tell you, and I shared this with Alan last week when we were on our hike, but I had a prodigal son in our family. I told you about my uncle. And it was this to me, the prodigal son is such a real story. My mom's brother, Uncle Mike, who looked just like me, or I looked just like him. That's what everybody says. Oh, you look just like your Uncle Mike. My Uncle Mike went off to college. He went to Florida College, but was there for 1 year and decided he wanted to move to San Francisco. And he went to San Francisco, and he got a roommate. And this roommate of his was a whole lot more than a roommate. My uncle was a homosexual and ended up getting AIDS. You know, he was gone for 20 years. No one knew where he was. He would only occasionally send a phone call He would only occasionally respond, and he never kind of admitted it to my grandparents. They had some indication that that was what was going on. My mom always kind of had a feeling, because she always felt like these roommates of his were a little too cuddly, a little too close. But about 20 years later, he shows up at about the age of 40, shows up at my grandparents' doorstep, penniless, dying of AIDS, and said, I got nothing. Came back to the Lord, did a little bit of preaching in his last 2 or 3 years, and died of AIDS at the age of 43. And that was that. And I think that this was, you know, the prodigal son comes to life when you have experiences like that in your own family, of somebody who lived gaily and lived in splendor. He lived it up, too. I mean, he just went through his money, just mooched off of anybody he could. He spent an insurance check that he got buying a Mercedes. So you can't pay your hospital bills. You can't pay off your debts. You can't pay off your credit cards. But you can spend an insurance check on a Mercedes. Good. Good. So you're dying of AIDS, but at least you're going to look good doing it. You know, and I, we all as a family, you know, we welcomed him back with open arms. Loved it. We loved that he spent some of his last couple of years traveling. He went to Florida College and did some preaching on making poor decisions down there. So to me, when I read the prodigal son, this, my Uncle Mike's face is what I see. And my grandpa's face, who was a preacher up in Portland, Oregon, is the father. That's the face that I put in this story. I hate to personalize it too much because I'm sure you all have kind of the face you put in the story too, but this is real stuff. This stuff happens. This is not just theory here. Now we meet the older brother in verse 25. Now his older son was in the field, and when he came and approached the house, he heard music and dancing, and he summoned one of the servants and began inquiring what these things might be, and he said to him, "Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he's received him back safe and sound." But he became angry and was not willing to go in. I imagine him kind of pouting outside, arms crossed, brow furrowed. And your father, let's see, and his father came out and began entreating him. I love this father. He goes out to the older brother. Same thing, that he goes to the prodigal son, runs to him. He goes out to the bitter older brother. He reaches out to his sons. He cares about his sons. Let's see, verse 29. And he answered and said to his father, "Look, for so many years I've been serving you, and I've never neglected a command of yours, and yet you've never given me a kid, a young goat, that I might be married with my friends. But when this son of yours," not my brother, he says, "but when this son of yours," how many spouses do that to each other? "Guess what your son did?" I hear that one all the time. "Guess what your son did this afternoon while you were out hiking?" Oops. "For so many years I've been serving you, I've never neglected the command of yours, yet you've never given me a kid that I might be married with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who devoured your wealth with harlots," he never really says that he devoured his wealth with harlots. It said that he lived gaily and in splendor, but I don't really see that he spent it on harlots. I think there might be a little side point there that sometimes people like the older brother, they just want to assume the worst. They want to assume the worst about everybody. "He probably spent all your money on prostitutes." Well, it just said he spent on loose living. Never says it was prostitutes. His older brother just assumes the very worst about him. And he said to him, "My child," in verse 31, "you've always been with me, and all that is mine is yours. But we had to be merry and rejoice, for this brother of yours was dead and has begun to live, and was lost and has been found." And we don't ever see what the older brother's response is. I love how Jesus teaches. Jesus is always the one who kind of has the open-ended story. You never really know. You never really know. A lot of these great parables, you never really know what ends up happening to any of these people. God just kind of leaves you wondering. And maybe the reason why Jesus leaves it open-ended is because he wants us to sit there and go, what would my response be?
I keep going back to the context there of why he's saying what he's saying.
Yeah.
The immediate audience, who is basically telling Jesus, "Why are you having dinner with these people?" Well, why are you spending so much time with them? As soon as he says, then the older brother, and begins this section, they have to know he's speaking right at them.
Yeah.
So the fact that he stops as abruptly as he does, they have to be sitting there going,
gritting their teeth.
Okay, what am I? What is my response? Like, how am I going to respond to these specific people who are here with Jesus? That's
And the older brothers of the world won't have the final word. The father.
Ooh, that's a good point.
Has the final word. I mean, it's a pretty complete story from that perspective.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what the older brother's response is. The father presents it as there is no other option. And he says, in New American Standard, he actually says, we had to be married. This was the only option. Your brother who was dead is alive now. We couldn't sit there and complain. We're not going to be bitter about this. We had to be married. This was the only loving and compassionate response to your brother's return, is we had to be married and rejoice because he's come back and he's alive now. And I just love it that there's no other option. It's not that, well, we chose to be married, or, you know, we wanted to rejoice. It's that we had to be married. What other response is there? And I imagine some Pharisees folding their arms and gritting their teeth a little bit, going, I don't like the way this is going. And maybe some other Pharisees kind of opening up and going, you know, he's right. You do have to be married. There's a world full of Gentiles. There's a world full of fallen Jews. There's a world full of tax collectors and sinners and women caught in adultery. And we've spent all this time just being angry at them. And here's God reaching his hand down, going to them, embracing them, because he wants them saved. And I could have a whole world of brothers and sisters, or I could be bitter and close myself off and sit outside while everybody else is having a party of salvation. Yeah, Alan?
I think the reason behind the older brother's bitterness is his view of himself.
Yeah.
Not necessarily his view of his younger brother, but his view of himself. The English Standard Version says, I never disobeyed your command.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have that view of yourself, you're probably not going to have the right view of the repentant, penitent person.
Yeah, because your standard is this high, all the way up here.
So it's not so much his view of the younger brother as it is, I've been better. I've been better than this other person. And that's just not the case.
Yeah,
he may have never come to himself.
He's never gotten a load of himself.
Took that journey, like you were saying, for the younger brother to see. But the father's response to the older brother is pretty extraordinary. I mean, the way Jesus the underlying pieces of the way Jesus portrays the father, and he never rebukes the brother.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of love and gentleness.
A very tender response.
It's almost like the father's mercy that goes towards both of them is a standing rebuke on the, you know, that the Pharisees would see how off they are, because he's so generous. I mean, and he does correct him, but he basically says, look, this is all yours. This is ours. It's not a world where I have to cut somebody else off for you to have something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think Paul the Apostle had a similar feeling in Romans 9. You know, he talks about in verse 1, I'm telling the truth in Christ, I'm not lying, my conscience bearing me witness in the Holy Spirit. I have great sorrow and unceasing grief in my heart over Jews who did not become Christians. For I could wish that I myself were accursed, separated from Christ, for the sake of my brethren, my kinsmen, according to the flesh. They're all Israelites, and they're the ones who had all the promises. They're the ones who have the commandment and the covenant. They're the ones who have the adoption as sons. And they're the ones by whom the Messiah came. And I love them. And I care about them. And it kills Paul. It kills Paul that there are his own people who are not accepting Christ when Christ came to them first, to the Jew first, and to the Gentile as well. And I think the father in the prodigal son story has the same feeling, that I love you. I care about you. You've always been with me. And the son's attitude is, well, where's my reward for it then? Right.
Romans 11, and the case that Paul's trying to make there is kind of on the Gentile side. You know,
the branches being grafted in. Yeah.
Here's this natural tree with branches, and that's the older brother. It's mm-hmm. it's natural for you to be here. You're meant to be here and do what you do. And here's this wild, unnatural branch that's being grafted in, basically given a shot to thrive and you know, be productive in a place where he would not have naturally been given that opportunity.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just kind of the goodness of God that he is allowing mm-hmm. the brother to come back, but the goodness of God that he's allowing the older brother to even be there in the first place. Like, you know, it's God who's in control of both of the situations.
Yeah, and in Romans 11, he specifically says that those branches that were cut off, they can be grafted back on. So it's there's not hope that's lost there. You know, even if a Jew were cut off, the branch were cut off to make room for the Gentile to be grafted in, he could still graft those branches back onto the tree. There's always room on God's tree for more branches. It's never going to be too much.
And the idea that he's just putting across there is, Gentiles, don't be so puffed up and proud that you've been given a shot.
Yeah.
Because everybody has a shot now. And that's kind of the opposite side of that, is the older brother is puffed up and prideful that, you know, he's in this position.
Yeah.
But it's really, that's the mystery, right? It's everybody now that has the opportunity.
Well, and it's come full circle then. The younger brother left in the first place because he was proud and wanted what was coming to him. And now the older brother is proud and wants what's coming to him. Where was my fattened calf? You didn't even give me a baby goat, let alone a fattened calf. I've been here all this time. Where's my reward? And it reminds me a little bit of when God was dividing up the promised land with the 12 tribes of Israel. You know, he gave this portion to Judah and this portion to Reuben, this portion to that, et cetera, et cetera. And he finally gets to the Levites. And he says, and the Levites, they don't get a portion of land because God is their inheritance. That's their portion. God is their portion. And, you know, when I read that, that makes me think about, if I were a Levite, would I be satisfied with God? Would I look at that and go, yeah, you're right, you know? If I have God, that's good enough for me. I'm satisfied. The reward for the older brother was not a fattened calf. The reward for the older brother was that he got to be in the Father's presence all those years. That he got to be with his Father. The younger brother wasted those years, and he's going to get to the end of his father's life. He's going to look at his father's deathbed and go, I wish I had not wasted those years. I wanted to be in my Father's presence. You know, just being with the Father, being a part of the family, being loved every day, being nurtured and cherished and cared about, and having a purpose and a job to do. That was the reward for the older brothers, that he was an integrated, loved, and cherished part of his Father's family. But he's going, well, where's my reward? Where's my fattened calf? Well, then you've just missed the whole point of being part of the family. You've missed the whole reward of being part of God's family. I guess, you know, there's some good applications. We've run out of time here. Some good modern applications that I don't want to, you know, we don't want to stretch the text beyond what the context is, because, you know, we need to understand that there was a specific audience that Jesus was talking to here for a specific purpose. But, you know, I see an application here of, you know, are we being very careful to be conscientious and loving of newer members at church? Are we being very careful about those who've just become Christians? Are we being very careful about those who've just moved to the area? And are we being careful not to get bitter when somebody has to come forward over and over and over again? Sometimes I think we get a little cynical. And there, every church has members like this, okay? Every church has members who every 3 months or so, they come forward and say, well, I've not been living right. I've not been faithful. I've not put God first in my life, and I need help. And then everyone gets excited, gives them big hugs, and helps them along. And 3 months later, they come forward again. You got church members who will come to church faithfully for 3 months, 6 months, and then they just disappear, and they're gone for 3 months. And then they show up again. Like, okay, I want to put God first in my life. And we get kind of cynical, like, well, here's Bob again. Bob came forward again. And we get a little bit cynical about it. You know, we can be the older brother sometimes in that regard. We need to rejoice. And maybe the reason why people have such a hard time being and staying faithful is that we kind of look at them a little suspiciously, like, okay, you know, we've heard this song and dance before. Are you actually repenting of sin, or are you just trying to get attention? Try not to assume the worst about a person, but try to assume the best of them. Don't be kind of the bitter. Don't be standing outside the party with your arms folded bitterly, assuming the worst about people. Do you have any other applications or comments before we close? Okay, cool. Who do you think was the main character of the story? There's no right or wrong answer. I think the main character is actually the older brother. Because the older brother he's the one who's supposed to learn the lesson. The younger brother had his lesson learned, but at the end of the story, Jesus isn't looking at the tax gatherers in the room. He's not eyeing them going, okay, tax gatherers, and that older brother really had a hard time with this. No. Who's he looking at the end of this story? He's looking those Pharisees right in the eye going, yeah, and that older brother had a hard time with this story. Not in that regard, if you want to look at who the object, who's supposed to learn something from this story at the end, then I think the older brother, in a way, is kind of the main character or the main thrust of it. You could say the father is the main character because he's kind of the glue that binds everything together. He's the one who's always out there. He's God. He's in all. He gives breath to all. He gives life to all. And he extends himself out to others. And you could say the prodigal son is the main character because if this prodigal son had never become a prodigal son, none of this would have happened. So his leaving was the catalyst for the rest of the story. Anyway, I just think it's an interesting story where, depending on your perspective, I think you could easily see any of those three characters are the main character. John?
There's some amazing phrases in this story, just like so many other places. Mm-hmm. If we listen carefully, when God says, all that I have is yours,
mm-hmm.
that's an amazing statement.
Yeah.
That floors you when you read that. Mm-hmm. It's like, wow. It makes you really think about and appreciate what God has done for us,
yeah.
and what He wants for us, and what He continues to do for us every day. Amazing.
Yeah.
To think of that, that you're that person that God is saying it to as well. All that I have is yours. What are you doing?
Yeah.
How can you say that? You're God.
In my household, there are many dwelling places. It's like, my house is your house. Yeah. I want you to come be a part of my family. And everything I have, it's at your disposal. You know, my power and my glory. And we're going to share His glory also. Yeah. We're going to be glorified as He's glorified, as Christ was glorified. We're going to share in that glory and that exaltation. So all that God has, you know, is the gift. And that was available to the older brother the whole time.
Right.
It's now available to the rejuvenated younger brother as well. Right? I'll let you have the last word.
Okay. Well, I'll let Paul have the last word then. It goes with, it's a commentary on all things I have are yours. 1 Corinthians 3:21-23. Therefore let no man glory in men, for all things are yours. Whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world or life or death or things present or things to come, all are yours, and you are Christ, and Christ is God's.
Mm-hmm. Well, do we usually end with a prayer, or do we just say goodbye? Or is there a protocol?
No, there's a protocol.
Okay. Well, thanks for your comments. Appreciate it.
Thanks for the class.